As Iyanla Van Zandt once said, it's important that we share our experiences with other people. Your story will heal you, and your story will heal somebody else. At Project Sleep, we believe that your stories matter, which is why we train people with sleep disorders on how to share their stories through our Rising Voices program. This Rising Voices podcast series features a variety of firsthand stories from people living with sleep disorders around the world. Each person's story offers unique and important insights.
Welcome to Project Sleep's podcast. Project Sleep is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and advocating for sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. I'm your host, Julie Flygar. We're so glad you're here as we work together towards making sleep cool. On this podcast, all guests express their own opinions. While medical diagnoses and treatment options are discussed for educational purposes, this information should not be taken as medical advice. Each person's experience is so unique, which is why it's so important to always consult your own medical team when making decisions about your own health. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a Project Sleep podcast episode. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a rating or review wherever you listen so that we can reach more listeners and raise more awareness. Hello, everybody. We have a very special guest with us, Jordan. Say hi, Jordan.
Hello. Hello, everybody.
Jordan Taylor is a recent graduate of the University of Alabama, where she had a prominent role on the university's speech and debate and slam poetry teams. Diagnosed with narcolepsy at the age of 14, Jordan joined Project Sleep's Rising Voices of Narcolepsy to share her story and raise awareness about this often misunderstood condition.
Thank you so much, Julie. So growing up, I was an avid reader. Now, when I moved from Virginia, where I am originally from, to Alabama for my undergraduate degree, I didn't read as much for like my extracurricular time, given how much I was reading during school. But during quarantine, I've read at least like 3 books. So I'm like kind of getting back onto it since graduation. But growing up, reading was just a huge part of my life. I think probably around middle school was when I was definitely reading the most. I grew up in a super small town. It has 13,000 people, 21,000 cows. So reading felt like a very good use of my time to get away from things. And it really did feel kind of like an escape from my small little world. Especially around the age of 12 was kind of when all this reading took off. I was in middle school. I was getting so invested in reading, writing. It was the first time in my life I really felt like I was starting to become really creative. So by the time I was in the 8th grade, I had joined my school's speech and debate team. And by the end of that year, I had made my first national final. Now, around this time in middle school, there was a book I read that really continues to stick out to me even, you know, years later at this point. Wow, like 10 years later at this point. And it was called The Mysterious Benedict Society. Now, this novel had everything that you could just want in a YA book. It basically had mischievous misfits, solving mysteries, like going about, like having adventures. But the thing that actually really stood out to me about this book was the children's mentor, who was later revealed in the book to have narcolepsy. Now, before we get to middle school and then kind of later on my high school years, these symptoms and weird nighttime occurrences that I've had for most of my life started quite early. Now, around the age of 10 is when I really remember my dreaming started to take off. One night I woke up in my bedroom and there was this little Victorian girl in my closet, and she wore a really long white lace dress and she had straight black hair that went all the way down her back. And when I first saw her, I remember just being terrified. But she would come out night after night and she would sit with me in my canopy bed that I had at the time. And eventually I just got used to her presence, and I probably would have even considered her like some kind of an imaginary friend. And I remember being 10 years old, I'm in the 5th grade, And I would go to school and I would be telling all my friends about these crazy dreams that I was having. And everyone was so impressed all the time. Like, I was the kid they always asked to tell like ghost stories when we were at campfires, and I would just tell them dreams I was having. It was funny how in the beginning, you know, dreaming just really felt like a superpower. But by the time that I had gotten through middle school and then on to high school was when things really started to change. I remember my freshman year of high school, I really struggled to suddenly stay awake during the day. You know, a nap in fourth period suddenly became a nap in every period. I remember specifically there was one instance in world history where I was lightly shaken awake by my teacher at the time. And she was asking me if I wanted water or if I needed to like get up and walk somewhere. And I remember being really confused and not exactly understanding her questions at the time. I honestly hadn't even realized that I had fallen asleep. After school that day, I went immediately home and I fell asleep again well into dinner. It was around this time that like my parents started to get concerned about all my excessive sleeping. But since I had had these vivid dreams forever and I really wasn't sleeping very well at night, we were pretty convinced at that point that I probably had some form of insomnia. So at that point, I am 14 years old and we drive 45 minutes from my small little town in Virginia to a neurology clinic, where at first they think that I probably have some form of like restless leg syndrome. Now, after a few weeks of medication and not much change, they decide to put me through a sleep study where I find out that I have narcolepsy. And I was sitting in this small little clinic so far away from my home when my neurologist looked at me and told me that you have narcolepsy. And I sat there really, really quiet for a minute because I was thinking about this book that I had read when I was 12 about this character having narcolepsy. And my doctor interrupts my thoughts and he says, "Well, have you ever heard of narcolepsy?" And I pause and I say, "Yes, I've heard of narcolepsy," thinking to myself, like, I read it in a book once, but the guy in the book just kind of like fell asleep. I feel like, you know, I'm not just falling asleep. There's so much more to this. And my doctor looked at me and said, "You know, you've probably never lived a normal life." And walking out at the age of 14, I didn't realize that this was about to be a huge shifting point in my life. At that point, I was a freshman. I was a straight A student. I was doing so well on the speech and debate team. I'd even just got my first boyfriend, right? And I really couldn't conceptualize the idea that I was having this huge, like, life-shattering diagnosis. To me, I just felt like they told me, like, "Hey, you sleep weird." And I was like, "Oh, okay." I didn't really understand what the ramifications of that were really going to look like or what that meant for me. So they started me on medication right away. And the first 6 months of just trying medication on and off were so draining. I remember one of the first medications I was on, it took away these sleep attacks that I was having during the day where I was falling asleep in class and not realizing it. But it wasn't taking away the tiredness. So I felt like I was walking through my days like a zombie. At that point, my doctors were like, "Well, let's increase the dose." And next thing you know, I'm having heart palpitations. I remember I was going into my sophomore year of high school, and I was just so sick of it at that point. I was tired of all the medications and nothing really changing. And so I thought to myself, you know, life before without medication wasn't that bad. So you fell asleep in class a few times, right? You were still doing super well. Like, you still were getting great grades. So at that point, I had a serious conversation with my mom and I just told her that I didn't want to be on medication anymore. And for a while that did work. I went to school and everything was pretty much okay, aside from being tired. But around the time I turned 16, that little girl was no longer in my closet anymore. Instead, she was replaced by a full-grown man. I remember just being terrified trying to go to sleep. So I started closing my closet door where the little girl had been and the man now was. And I would close the closet door and I would open the door to my bedroom and I would turn on the hallway light and I would try to sleep like that. And it didn't work very long because eventually an elderly woman started sitting outside my door in a rocking chair and watching me sleep. I remember one night I woke up just covered in bees. I was so terrified and anxious about going to sleep at night. I had this choice of, well, you could stay up and not be seeing all these like strange things, and then you'll be tired the next day, or you can go to sleep and you can be really scared, and then you're still going to be tired the next day. I just really suddenly felt like my symptoms and what was going on was kind of getting away from me. Now, around this time, something else happened that really threw me for a loop. I was home alone one evening and I was sitting in my bed and I sat up and I decided I wanted to go get cereal. And I took one step around the bed and I just collapsed. I mean, my limbs fell on top of me and just felt like cement. I couldn't move. I could breathe. I couldn't really look around, but I knew where I was. And I just had no idea what was happening. I remember laying there and not so much being worried that I was effectively paralyzed on the ground, but my mind for some reason thought, what if a burglar breaks in right now? I am very, very vulnerable in this position. Either way, I was there for what might have been 30 seconds, what might have been 30 minutes. It just felt like forever. When the feeling finally came back, I tried walking and I felt like I was okay again. At this point, it just fully felt like my body was getting away from me. So I'm 16. My life looks great on the outside, but at home, my parents can kind of tell that I'm really starting to fade away. There were kids at school who told me that I was just making up my diagnosis so that I could sleep a little longer in class. I remember just feeling so sad, not knowing what to do at that point in time. So my parents ended up taking me to a therapist, hoping that that would be helpful. And once I explained to them that I was having a lot of anxiety over these weird visions I was having, they were convinced, or this therapist was, that I had schizophrenia. So they went and had me do an MRI. No matter how many times I tried to explain, like, no, this is just a part of this other diagnosis that I have. And I just remember feeling like nobody understood. I felt like I was constantly having to prove to both my peers and medical professionals that like there was something wrong with me. Narcolepsy isn't as straightforward, I think, as a lot of people would guess that it is. It's a chronic neurological disorder. It affects one's sleep-wake cycle. I think a lot of people have this misconception that you have narcolepsy and you just fall asleep all the time, and it can be comical in a way. When in reality, it's your body attempting to normalize or equalize a sleep-wake cycle that is entirely out of whack. Moreover, it affects a lot more people than I think we realize. Narcolepsy affects 1 in 2,000 people, which is essentially 200,000 Americans and 30 million people worldwide. With that being said, there are some pretty common symptoms when it comes to narcolepsy. The first and probably the hallmark of the condition is excessive daytime sleepiness. As I said, with narcolepsy, the body struggles to regulate a healthy sleep-wake cycle. And with that comes an overwhelming sense of tiredness. For people who don't have narcolepsy, this is equivalent to staying awake for 48 to 72 hours. It's that type of tiredness that someone with narcolepsy carries almost every single day. This was the reason that for me, I was falling asleep during my world history class and not even beginning to realize it. The next big symptom of narcolepsy is called cataplexy. Cataplexy is a sudden loss of muscle tone. that is often caused or accompanied by an emotional reaction. This can be joy, surprise, anger, sadness. And this loss of muscle tone can be on a full range, anywhere from feeling like your jaw is slackening, your head is drooping to your sternum, to even full body paralysis. If full body paralysis does happen, the person is entirely conscious the whole time. And this paralysis can last anywhere from 30 seconds to what can be like multiple minutes. This was what had happened to me at 16 when I fell just attempting to go get cereal, and I just didn't know what was happening. Another symptom of narcolepsy is hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations. These are tactile, visual, auditory hallucinations that happen upon waking and falling asleep. These are the reason that I kind of knew something was wrong. I had been hallucinating for 4 years probably before I went to see a sleep specialist. They're still the biggest symptom that I have today. The next symptom is sleep paralysis. Now, sleep paralysis is when upon waking or sometimes even falling asleep, one can no longer move their body. And often during this time, people can also have hallucinations as well. And then finally, there's disrupted nighttime sleep. So like I said, I feel like a huge misconception about narcolepsy is just that people who have it fall asleep all the time, when in reality, it is this sleep-wake cycle that is entirely out of whack. So disrupted nighttime sleep, for example, people who have narcolepsy might fall asleep a lot throughout the day, but because their sleep-wake cycle is entirely disrupted, they might struggle to fall asleep at night. This is exactly why for years, my parents just thought that I had insomnia. If my body were left to its own devices, I think that I would sleep for 3 hours, be awake for 3 hours, sleep for 3 hours, and on and on and on and on. Now, with that being said, there are two types of narcolepsy. There's narcolepsy with cataplexy, and then there's narcolepsy without cataplexy, which in recent years have been referred to as narcolepsy type 1 and type 2. It really goes to show that narcolepsy isn't a one-fits-all condition. It affects people differently, and how these symptoms showcase or express themselves can vary from person to person. For example, I have a friend who she has cataplexy constantly, whereas I rarely have attacks, if ever. But on the other hand, I'm constantly hallucinating and having dreams that feel like they're bleeding into the waking world, whereas that's not really something that she has to deal with. Now, there are ways that one gets diagnosed with narcolepsy. There is a nighttime and then a daytime portion. So the nighttime portion is polysomnography, which is basically what we understand to be a sleep study. They will hook you up to some EEGs and electrodes, and then you basically sleep through the night and they see if there's anything out of the ordinary. I remember when I got mine, I had 19 electrodes on my body, and I thought that that was the coolest thing. But what's also funny about when I went and got my sleep study was, as I've been telling you, I wasn't sleeping ever. It felt like I just was staying awake all night long and I was so tired during the day. And so when I got to this sleep study, I went in and I slept 8 hours of just sound sleep. I woke up the next morning and I was so distraught. I was like, they are never going to believe me that something's wrong. That was the best night of sleep I've ever gotten. But luckily, there is a second portion to it, which is the multiple sleep latency test. This is where they'll keep you throughout the day after your sleep study, and they'll ask you to try and take like a 20-minute nap every single hour. People who have narcolepsy will often fall asleep very quickly and will rapidly enter REM sleep or dream sleep. If you enter in so many naps, sleeping, and then into dream sleep, then it's most likely the case that you may have narcolepsy. For me, I fell asleep during 5 and dreamed during 4. I think for that last nap, I didn't want to dream anymore. I was just ready to leave. Now, narcolepsy, unfortunately, doesn't have a cure, but there are a lot of ways that we can treat symptoms and we can also manage them from a more holistic standpoint as well. There are wake promoters or stimulants for daytime sleepiness. There's nighttime medications, usually of a sedative nature, for daytime sleepiness and cataplexy. There's antidepressants also for cataplexy. And then there are always scheduled daytime naps. There are other ways as well that don't have to do with medication, such as coping as a way of treatment management. There's social support, being a part of systems like Rising Voices of Narcolepsy, of Project Sleep, of even having a small group in your area that you meet with to talk about your symptoms and what it's like to live with narcolepsy. There's also this improvement in overall general health. People will adjust their diets, they'll exercise more, they'll try to eliminate other facets in their life that may cause not so great health in order to make their narcolepsy feel a little better. I know for me, it's funny because last summer when I was putting this presentation together, I remember I had written down that I still felt like I hadn't found a treatment kind of regimen for me. And I was at that point, 6 or 7 years into my diagnosis, and just really felt like I was still searching for something. But it's amazing what a year can change. I know I'm currently on a stimulant. I'm on a nighttime medication. I'm also on antidepressants. But more than that, I do have a great social group. I've really gone out of my way to identify other areas in my life that I can make better so that I can feel better as a person. And I can now confidently say that for the first time in, you know, a really long time, I kind of feel like my narcolepsy and my body are really under control. So life with narcolepsy. For me, self-expression has been a huge part of coping with it all. I think for a really long time, I struggled to understand that my narcolepsy didn't define me. It was just kind of this lens through which I was seeing the world through. I was lucky enough to finish high school as a salutatorian. I interned at the very neurology clinic that I had been diagnosed at 3 years prior. And for my senior project when I was in high school, I went around to local high schools in Central Virginia. And I talked with them about how we can be more aware of things like narcolepsy and sleep in adolescence so that we can identify and maybe not stigmatize kids like me. At that point, I went to college where I had a lot of success with my poetry and on the slam poetry team. I had the ability to write a speech about how we could make speech and debate more accessible. That way that we could make it easier for everyone and give everyone the same chance when they were competing. And that speech placed 10th last year at the national competition. My senior thesis in college was all about sleep. And I even had the opportunity to go to UConn to give a speech about what it's like to date as a young person who has a chronic condition, disability, and your partner just doesn't. What do romantic relationships look like in that way? So yeah, especially since I got my diagnosis, like I said, I think for a long time, all I thought was, I am Jordan and I have narcolepsy. When in reality, there was so much more about me that I had and that I was really sharing with the world. It took me a really long time to be able to see that. So the future with narcolepsy. So I just graduated, as I've said, and I'm actually going to be finishing up some pre-medical classes this fall. I'll be going back to Virginia to be with my family. And then I'll be applying for medical school next year. I do a lot of research right now that has to do with disability, illness, and the humanities. And that is what I would really strive to do kind of as my livelihood, especially maybe I could be a teacher at a medical school someday. One of the biggest things that I really want to do for my life as I'm doing now is to be an advocate for rare disorders and disability. As I've said, I think for a really long time, I made narcolepsy the cornerstone of my life, and I didn't realize that I could be anything more. Sharing my story not only is me reclaiming that part of myself talking about the fact that I am more than a diagnosis on a piece of paper. But I also want to raise awareness for others that, you know, disorders of any kind, variants in medical conditions, they exist all around us. They don't rob anybody of their humanity, nor do they define who we are as people, right? And I think sharing these stories with everyone, whether you have narcolepsy or not, is a way that we can really begin to look around us at our neighbors, at our common people, and understand that our empathy can go a long way towards others. And we could do right and we could help other people the more that we have open conversations about it. You know, I don't think my storybook fairy tale life is necessarily working out yet. And when I got diagnosed with narcolepsy, sometimes I felt like it was the end of maybe this storybook that I had had like in my mind for years. But as I've gotten older, I'm just beginning to realize it was a big turning point in a new chapter. Like I said, though, we still have a very long ways to go. We've got to raise awareness. There is a lot of misconceptions about narcolepsy from just in our very communities to even the medical profession, which makes it no wonder that sometimes there's an 8 to 15 year average between symptom onset and then diagnosis. Currently, under 50% of people are diagnosed with narcolepsy who have it. Having these open conversations, talking about what a life with narcolepsy actually looks like, could help destigmatize a lot of ideas around this disorder and also could help those who don't know that they have it yet. I would like to go ahead and thank Rising Voices and also Julie for giving me this opportunity to speak and to share my experiences. I am very grateful to have a life with narcolepsy and know at the end of the day that it isn't the end-all be-all or the definition of who I am. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Yay, Jordan! I'm clapping on behalf of other people. They're all clapping. Great job. That was so wonderful. It's just, there's so many different little quotes in there that just really resonate so much with my own experience and with so many people I've heard from.
Are you facing sleep issues or sleep disorder? Project Sleep is now excited to have the Sleep Helpline, a nonprofit-led free national helpline providing personalized support and resources. You can reach out today to speak with a compassionate resource specialist who will listen and help provide accurate sleep disorders information, resources to help navigate daily living and the healthcare landscape, and connect you with a certified sleep center and patient support organizations. Contact the Sleep Helpline at 1-800-819-2043 or by filling out a form on our website at project-sleep.com.
Well, first of all right, the bangs. We just got to talk about bangs really quick.
Hair is so bad. I don't know. Because here's the thing. Like, my hair changes a lot. Like, a lot. It's naturally curly in all of those pictures. I'm, like, straightening it at that time. And so I guess because I was wearing my hair straight always, I was like, I can do bangs. Like, my hair is straight. And then I would go outside in humidity and I would just look so bad. And they were so chunky. I don't know why my parents said they looked good. Because years later, they're like, oh, those are awful. That was like the worst hair you ever had. And I was like, why? Why didn't nobody tell me this at the time? Why'd you let me walk around like that for like months? I think I had them. Oh my gosh. I gave like a graduation speech with those. It was terrible.
Well, I'm a big fan of bangs. I will say,
they look good on you. They look really good on you.
Thank you. So bangs aside, so it's so cool that you're thinking about, there's so much of your story that's just so amazing. But I was interested to hear if you would share a little bit about your decision to go to medical school and if that had anything to do with your experience, you know, living with narcolepsy. Was that always kind of a passion area or what did that journey look like?
It's funny because, for years, I actually thought that I wanted to be a journalist. I was very convinced in high school. I was like, oh, I'm good at like speech and debate. Like, I'll be like, you know, on broadcast news or whatever. I'll be a journalist. I always wanted to like maybe write for like the New York Times or something. But my senior year, when I was doing this senior project I had to do in high school, I was really running out of time to like pick a project idea. And my mom was like, oh, you should do it about sleep. And I was like, no, that's a cop out. I'm not going to do that. And interestingly enough, I decided to do it thinking it was just like, oh, I know what sleep is. Like, oh, like, it'll be fun. And I went back and I worked at that neurology clinic and I fell in love with it. I adored it. I remember being like 17 and being like, I have to do this for the rest of my life. This is like absolutely great. It's incredible. And so I would like to say it's because I was living my life like as someone who had, you know, a neurological condition, but it really wasn't. It actually took me going through the door and being like, this is really great and this is really fun and I actually adore it.
That's awesome. That's so great. Well, we can't wait to hear how your journey goes. And are you looking to do neurology, you think, or?
Yeah, I actually do think I would like to go into neurology. I really did enjoy my time at the clinic. I really love the brain. Like when I was going through school, my school didn't offer like a neuroscience degree, but I did take a lot of classes. So that was kind of like what my huge focus on and why I ended up doing pre-medical, because I just knew like I really wanted to be a doctor.
Can you tell us a little bit about your project? You said you did a project on access needs.
Mm-hmm. So my junior year of college, I was on the speech and debate team. And I had decided to write this speech about what it was like to have a disability or a chronic illness or just a condition, if that's the word that you prefer. And what it was like to try and like stay healthy while also participating in speech and debate. And for years, it was really like funny for me, like having narcolepsy and being in speech and debate. I was very well known for falling asleep in random places. Probably the funniest was Chicago's Grant Park while we were there doing a competition. And when I was in high school, it wasn't too terrible. It was just something that I, you know, dealt with. But once I got to college, I really felt like the needs that I had and the, you know, kind of the accommodations, maybe for another word, that I really needed to be able to thrive in speech and debate really weren't being offered to me. And I also felt that they were being almost actively ignored. I really felt like I was having to explain my condition over and over again. And I was just kind of met with blank stares of like, oh, well, it's not that bad. Like I've read about it. It's really not that bad. And by the time I'd gotten to my junior year, I felt really frustrated by it all. And I had a really incredible coach who was on the team who helped me draft this speech. And we ended up interviewing like 40 other competitors who had like illness or disability. And they all spoke about their experiences and we compiled it all into this big book and we rewrote the national wellness guidelines and we resubmitted them. I wrote about how you could get an ADA claim if you needed one. And we just generally spoke about how our activity that we all loved and wanted to be a part of, how it needed to be more inclusive, because disability, rare disorders, conditions, like everyone has them and they're all around us. And I know for me, like at one point it had gotten so bad that I was genuinely considering like filing an ADA claim against like one of these coaches that I had. And I was like, you know, in the process of compiling evidence. And I really felt like this speech was me saying like, no, like I'm good at what I do. And other people like myself deserve to have the same chance. So it was a really wonderful project. And I think it's something that I'm always really going to remember fondly.
That's so cool. What an amazing project. And I think so many people will benefit. I hope that they will benefit from that down the road. The work that you had to put in and even the bad experiences that you had to go through, I hope paved a better path for other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
You mentioned that you did a thesis on sleep.
Yes,
evaluation. I did. Tell us a little bit about that.
I feel like I can't get away from sleep at this point. I feel like it's like my number one talking point almost. But for my senior thesis in college, I did one on sleep valuation, which basically means how much value one places in sleep. I think most people with narcolepsy, we place a lot of value in our sleep. But I was looking specifically at what sleep valuation looked like in college students. Because obviously college students have very, very weird sleep schedules. Like they're not people who have your typical like 11 to 7. So we wanted to see what sleep valuation looked like specifically in a population of people who had like really weird, like crazy kind of sleep patterns. And it ended up being really great. We had like over 200 participants and we got some pretty solid results. So like that was another fun thing that we got to do, like all about just sleep stuff.
And did you show that college students don't have good value of sleep, or they do, or?
What we had found was in college students who were like more anxious and more depressed, they tended to value their sleep more. And then also students who got worse sleep also tended to value their sleep more. So like if you didn't have very good sleep or you weren't sleeping well, you like would value it, or you would like want to have probably like more sleep. So those were kind of like our preliminary findings on it.
So cool. So neat. I could nerd out for a while. that's so cool. So we have some questions from the audience. Okay. So Steven wants to know, how do you deal with the hallucinations?
I could actually show you how I deal with that. So I've had a bunny since I was 10. She's on the bed right now. I'll actually just bring her over.
I love bunnies. I have bunny slippers on. Does that count?
So I have this bunny. And I got her when I was 10, which was around the time that the hallucinations started. So inadvertently, I know a lot of people who have narcolepsy will either get a dog or some type of cat, like, or, you know, they'll be sleeping with a partner. And so if someone's having a hallucination, they'll be able to like look, and, you know, if no one else in the room is panicked or, you know, moving or scared, like you can kind of tell at that point, like as a grounding technique, almost, that like, you're okay. Like no one's breaking in, no one's, you know, throwing stuff around. But for me, especially from a young age, even though, you know, I lived obviously with my family, you are in a room alone and it can feel really scary. So for a really long time, and I mean, I still do, you know, obviously have my bunny. That was kind of like the big grounding technique of like, you know, when I was 10, it was very comforting. And now as an adult, like, it's still very comforting. But I know when I go to bed, like, I have to know my doors are locked, which is just like a safety thing in general. But also I can't sleep with any doors open, like my bathroom door, my bedroom door, my closet door, like all doors have to be closed. I can't sleep with any open, because that's always, I don't know why, but my hallucinations just always want to like stand in door frames and like be weird. So that's the big one, is not giving them spaces that they can kind of even appear in. And it's weird because it works. You think like they would just like find a different place to be in the room. But once I close the doors, like it has been very helpful.
Yeah, I can't stop laughing because my windows are the same way. And yeah. I really like to leave my windows open in the back of but it's my hallucinations that, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that's, I love your bunny. So,
thank you.
All right. So Matthew wants to know a little bit more about disability and relationship experience.
Oh, this one has a lot of stories. So, I wrote a creative nonfiction thing or prose, if you will, in college, because I had a creative writing minor, and I wrote specifically about what it was like when you kind of have like a disability or a condition, however you identify with it, and what did that mean for dating. And I know for me, I had a lot of big questions that I feel like peers my age didn't really have to ask themselves before going on dates, you know, like, how many dates before you tell someone that you have narcolepsy, right? Or how many dates, or how long do you let a relationship go on until you feel comfortable allowing them to like come sleep over, right? Like I know for me, I do take, you know, a nighttime medication that is a sedative. And so I am pretty comatose in the evening. So how much do you have to get to know someone? Like how much do you have to trust someone before you let them and basically come be with like, you're just like, you know, you're just knocked out body, right? It's more than just sleeping. It's the not being able to wake up. That's kind of like the scary part, you know? Moreover, I think another big thing that came out of it as well was just, you know, all the conversations that have to happen when you date someone, right? Especially like the weird conversations you have before you tell them. You know, like I don't always feel comfortable drinking a lot in situations that are unfamiliar to me, because that like alcohol always makes me have like cataplexy attacks. Like once I'm like past, I feel like it's always 5 drinks in and my body's like, all right, time to drop. It's just like, we have like our meter, our scale. And so when you're in college, like that can be kind of awkward. Like sometimes when you just say, oh, I don't drink, like people don't really think that's like a fun or like an interesting or a sexy answer. You know, it's kind of like, oh, really? Why? Like, what's the issue there? Or another thing too, you know, say you have a crush on someone and they call you at like 11 p.m. and they're like, hey, come out and party. And you're like, I've already taken my medicine, you know? Like at that point, even if there wasn't anything to do the next day, like I don't really have a choice in the matter, right? And so I had just written this paper about, you know, like what do all those questions mean and how do you address them? Like, what does that like make relationships kind of look like? And then I had the opportunity to present it at this disability studies course at UConn. I think my favorite thing though, like my favorite story ever of like dating with narcolepsy, AKA like, you know me, was one time I told like one of my very first boyfriends, I remember I was like, I have narcolepsy. And he goes, I didn't know you had seizures. And I was like, already, I don't know how to like come back. I think I just said, no, not epilepsy. And then from there, I can't even remember how the conversation went because I was so like struck when he said that. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, I could keep this show going. We could go back and forth.
I bet. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
My favorite was being on a first date and when I finally said I have narcolepsy. And about the way I presented at that point, I felt like I was pretty confident. I said, I have a blog. I was just in Mary Claire magazine, you know? So I was like, I wasn't saying it of like a point of weakness. I just ran a marathon, you know, like those kind of things. And then he said, is there anything else wrong with you I should know about?
Oh no. Oh no. I once had a boy tell me, he was like, why is it so bad? It sounds so cute. And I was like, okay.
Okay. We won't keep the show going for anyone that we'll have another show. Sometime. Yeah. All right. So Cassandra knows I've been working on how to pronounce her name correctly. what is your best advice for someone with narcolepsy who is in college? Any study tips or schedule habit tips that you might be able to recommend?
What's funny is actually, whenever I give tips to people who do have narcolepsy in college, my biggest first tip, not regarding things of like, oh, studying and this and that, is always know your rights. Know your disability office, know what you are like entitled to, know like the laws that affect you, because they can be different from public universities to private universities. My biggest thing there is like, know where you are ADA protected, like know what you should be allowed to have. I think one of the biggest mistakes that I made in college at times was telling myself like, oh, I can handle it. Like it's on me. When in reality, like that doesn't have to be the case. I was very fortunate that Alabama had a pretty good disability services office and professors were more than accommodating. I never had a professor who like ever was like, oh no, like I can't help you, because disability accommodations there are just like an accepted thing, you know? So like whenever I came up, as long as I was communicative and saying like, hey, is there just any way like for this project, like a week from now, like 2 weeks from now, if I could just like maybe need some help, like I would say 10 times out of 10, I never had an issue. And so I think a lot of times, like when kids first go to university, the thing that I'm always like very adamant to talk about is know your rights, like be communicative with your professors, like let people help you. That was like my biggest problem. I like in high school, like I like nobody wanted to accommodate me. So I got to college, like it's on me. I do it on my own, but it is okay. It is entirely okay to let people help you. Other study tips are go to bed at a normal time. I did that in college. Like I prioritized sleep. Don't let anyone take that away from you. Like prioritize sleep because you want to. I always went to bed at like 10 or 11. Like I made that a huge point in my life. I was like, this is as important as doing my assignments. This is as important as like making friends. Like this is as important as my GPA. Like my sleep is important. When you make sleep a chore, you're going to hate it. Like college is going to suck. Like you're only going to think about all the parties you're missing or this or that. Make sure that sleep is a priority and then know yourself well enough to when you can kind of like throw it to the wind. Like I always knew weekends I had off and when I didn't have like work to do, and I knew when I could go out and I could stay out till like 4 a.m. Right. So those I think would be more tactical. But my big one is always like, know your rights, like know what you have.
I love that. That was wonderful. Thank you. Matthew wants to know, did you ever experience cataplexy during debating experiences?
Yes, I did. Not often. There were only two instances after 8 or 9 years of debate. There was one that happened my sophomore year, and it was one of those like slow burn cataplectic attacks for people who don't have narcolepsy. Usually you can kind of feel when a cataplexy attack is coming on. I wouldn't say it's similar to being drunk, but it's kind of when you've had that like last strength between tipsy and drunk and you know it's coming, like you're like, all right, in 5 minutes, like I'm going to be gone. So I remember I was at a tournament and I just was like in a round and I just felt like my shoulders like just did not want to be shoulders anymore. They wanted to be elbows. Like they were already starting to droop. And I think it took like 30 minutes for it to happen. I was just sitting there like, no, we can handle, we can stay up. And then I eventually like slid down a wall and that was that. And then there was one other time, it was at Nationals last year where we were walking into my semifinal round actually. And I just went, wait, because I felt it happening. And I just kind of stumbled a bit and somebody caught my elbow and I luckily didn't fall or anything. But those were the only two times that it happened. So I was very thankful for that.
I think that makes a sense a lot to me. I think a lot of people have asked me about if I have cataplexy when I speak. I don't so much. It's more like very close personal relationships, I find, yeah, that tend to cause cataplexy. So I'd be much more likely to have it walking down the street with a very close friend or a mm-hmm. loved one than giving a presentation. You know, I think that's kind of the interesting thing when people think strong emotions too. You know, I think it's just a lot more about our personal relationships and communicating with loved ones. But debate's interesting. So I wonder if you would ever feel annoyed and that annoyance and satisfaction of being like knowing that you're about to be right about something. I feel like that.
I have a friend who her name is Becky and she also does speech and debate and she has a lot more cataplexy than I do. She could probably speak more to that point. But I know for me, I think like a lot of my cataplexy attacks just more so came from tiredness at a certain point. I do think the second one, I was just so excited and nervous for this round that my body almost like skipped a beat for a second. I just was like, oh. But I the first one, I think I was just so tired that my body at that point, like, I don't even think it took a strong emotion. I think my body was like, let's just slouch. I'm like, okay.
Yep, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. The pressure towards REM sleep. It's like your body was going to get to REM sleep one way or another. It was either like cataplexy or sleep. Yeah.
You have two choices. What about neither?
Cassandra has another question. She would like to know that, especially during this tough time, being at home, how do you keep yourself productive?
I would like to say that I keep myself productive, but I don't know if that's a true statement. I think for me, during the initial part of quarantine, I, of course, was finishing up college, right? So I had the senior thesis that I was focusing on, all these classes, and I had to do these presentations and these exams. So that initially, I almost like didn't even notice like lockdown because I just had so much work to do. And I had very strong deadlines. So it was like, I can't ignore this or else like I'm gonna get an F and we can't be, you know, doing that. But I think once school ended, I had some personal, like just like research projects or things that I was working on that had to take a little more self-discipline. And I think for the most part, I ended up like kind of keeping myself like on track. I know I had another presentation this past week that had to do with why we need disability poetry in medical schools, which was like some research that I've been working on. But I think actually, maybe I'm not the best person to ask like about productivity during quarantine because, you know, I just graduated college. I felt like I actually took quarantine to like have time off from like a very, very busy, very work intensive time in my life. And so like now, you know, I'll still have a class in fall and I'll, you know, applying for jobs right now and hopefully like that'll turn out okay. But I think like for the most part during quarantine, keeping myself productive just meant finding things that were fun, like finally picking up things that I had no time to do. I finally bought this book that I've been wanting to read for like 2 years and I finally got it and I read it. It was amazing. And I was like, why have I waited so long? So I think it was just finding things that like still made me feel happy and passionate really just adhering to those, prioritize the good things.
We have so many questions. This is unbelievable. All right. You guys are amazing. Iris, she wants to know if you find that narcolepsy can sometimes negatively impact relationships.
I will say I did feel like at times narcolepsy did negatively impact like my dating life. I think when I was a lot younger, like say around like 18, beginning of college, like, you know, kind of like new to the world, I felt very discouraged at times where I would tell someone about my narcolepsy and they not only didn't understand it, but kind of weren't willing to understand it. I think that was something that like could be so disheartening, to just feel like this was a part of you that was just like very integral. Like it wasn't something that was going to go away. It's something that is at times going to impact the relationship, whether that's good, bad, or neutral. And so to have people that you were interested in or that you cared about, like even a little, kind of be like, oh, that, or like, what does that mean? Or like, oh, that's kind of a lot. Like that at times was really like disheartening. And then later on, just so very frustrating. I remember at one point I had a really long conversation with my mom and I said, you know, like, I'm really tired of telling people that I have narcolepsy, not because I'm ashamed or embarrassed of it. I'm absolutely not. Like, it is just, it's a part of my life. It's the same as saying like my hair is brown. Like it just is, like, I just am, you know? But I told her I was just so tired of explaining it because it's not like a 10-minute story. I mean, you know, we all give these 20-minute rising voices stories, but I know like Julie can probably tell you, and all of us could say, like, I could talk for 3 or 4 hours and not even scrape the surface of like what narcolepsy in my life has looked like. It just, that there is no describing it sometimes. And I was just on this phone call with my mom and I was saying, like, I'm tired of either having to have 45 or 50 minute conversations with like people who are staring blankly at me the whole time, or like giving like a 5-minute synopsis that's like doesn't even cover it, and just like hoping people just move on. And so I almost got to a point where I felt like I just really wasn't bringing it up to people unless I had to, or like people that I felt like were really seriously going to date me. And so luckily for me, like my dating life was like kind of affected by it, but like my actual relationships, like I'm in a really wonderful relationship right now, those luckily have not taken any type of toll from it. Like when anything like was to happen, like whether that's a cataplexy attack or just like my stuff at night, just like sleeping kind of in arrangements, that's mostly just been met with like, okay, what do we have to do? And then like, that's it. You know, it's just like it's just a logistical thing, as opposed to, you know, like this big, like huge, just like deal breaking moment. So I've been very fortunate in that regard, but I will say my dating life was like very weird for a while where I was like trying to figure out like how to balance the two.
Okay. We have another question from Alex. I think Alex is joining from Australia, if I remember correctly. Did you struggle with brain fog and its effect on articulation when you're speaking or debating? Any coping strategies?
I do get brain fog. I definitely get brain fog. I get it when I'm reading a lot. I feel like I get through a chapter and I'm like, I didn't even read any of that and I have to restart. Like that's what brain fog is to me all the time. But I feel like because I started speech and debate, I mean, literally I was 13. And when I first started, I was only like 3 weeks after my 13th birthday. You know, it wasn't like I was solidly 13 by any means. Because I've been doing it for so long, and because I was doing it before my symptoms got really bad and before I knew what brain fog even was, I feel like I adapted almost immediately. You know, it would be like if you were like woodworking or had some hobby before like narcolepsy symptoms really onset, like you kind of find a way to still do it. I think when I pick up newer hobbies, I'm kind of like, oof, like sometimes adapting's like a little more different, right? But any advice that I have for brain fog when it comes to things like articulation would probably be practice. I know when it comes to like any of my speeches or any of my presentations, I'm just so comfortable with my voice, I think, at this point, because I'm so used to just talking to others that I always know my speaking points. And even when I'm tired, I can just like blah, 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 blah. Like I can autopilot and that works, right? And so I think if you're trying to give presentations and you're worried about missing that, my advice is always like practice, practice, practice. Like, or at the very least, know your talking points. That way you can still just like say something from there. I think that would probably be the best thing. Or well, Julie, do you ever deal with this? Because you have very many speaking engagements, so.
I find that mostly my sleepiness hasn't impacted my speaking engagements too much because it's such high adrenaline for me. Yeah. You know, it's like you're in front of people. And there was one time that I was about to go on and speak, and then they introduced the person that was right after me. It was one of my biggest speaking, I think it was like 600 people or something.
Wow.
So it was a big one, and it was a long time ago. So I was still pretty new to it. So I had like, my adrenaline was super high, right? And then I was about to go on stage and they announced the next person instead of me. And so then I was both angry and like confused. And I was the only patient speaking at a conference too. So it makes you feel like, oh, you just happened to skip over the one patient speaking. Mm-hmm. And so then I went into the hallway and my anger all at once transitioned to sleepiness. And yeah. Then I basically had to go on right after this other person. So I had like 30 minutes. I didn't really have time to like go anywhere and take a nap. And I remember that was like really, really challenging because then I felt angry and tired and then had to reset myself to somehow go back up and like have positive energy to go give a presentation. But I think that was just more of like a mix of emotions. Yeah. So I haven't felt like it's affected my speaking too much in particular. I just feel like it's like what you said about practicing too. I think that's, you know, really important and doing that when you have your best wakefulness probably.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. I don't know. No perfect solutions. I love what you said earlier about productivity. You're like, I'm not sure I'm the person to ask, you know, like we all just try our best, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like that. It's like, I think that's how I conceptualize things at this point. I'm like, I do accomplish things and I do get things done. Are they everything on my mind? No, but that doesn't mean I'm not still doing things in my life.
Okay, Kita. Hi. So she wants to know if you drive.
I do drive. So that's one of the big things. I've never had an issue with driving, which I feel very, very fortunate for. I think that is something I feel like I do have a big privilege in that I can drive. I will say though that I cannot drive for a long time really like by myself. So the farthest I've ever driven by myself was probably like 5 or 6 hours. And then the farthest that I have driven with another person in the car has actually been 11 or 12. But like if I'm doing like, I think the longest I can do just like on my own would be 5 hours. But like if someone's there and I can just talk to them, I can drive for a really long time. Like I just need to stay engaged. And I actually think like once again, something that's kind of like a weird blessing of growing up in kind of like a small town and also getting diagnosed super early on is everything's an hour from me. Like, you know, like if I want to buy new clothes or if I want to go to the doctor's office, like it is an hour long drive. And so like at a certain point, you know, I think I remember being a kid and being like, all right, you just have to like figure out how to do it. Like, even if you are tired, you know, like gotta turn on the AC or like blare some music or like do something. I do drive, and luckily I've not been in an accident, so we're okay.
And then Steven wants to know which book that you read that you were really excited to read.
Delia, I think that's how you say it, maybe it's Delilah, but it's Delia Owens' Where the Crawdads Sing. So super good. I really love Southern literature. It is very much Southern writing and it's super good. I super recommend it. I know it's like a few years late. Like, wasn't this book so popular in like 2017 or something? I don't know, but I just got around to reading it. It was super good.
That's awesome. Is that fiction or nonfiction?
It is fiction. It's amazing. I super suggest getting it.
No more books in this household.
I know. I just have them stacked everywhere at this point. Like, it's becoming embarrassing. I feel like they're furniture at this point. Like, they're just so tall.
And then people say ebooks are a thing. I don't know. I'm still not into it, but.
I used to have like a Nook. Like the Barnes and Noble, and I don't know what it was. I could not get into it. Maybe I need to try it again. You know, maybe I need to like go for round two. Like I read research articles all the time on my computer and that doesn't bother me.
I print those.
Oh, really? You have to? Okay.
I have binders of articles.
I guess it's because I was just in college. So printing's so expensive. I was like, no, you got to do it like this. So.
Well, that is it for questions. thank you so much for all that you've done. I think it's so cool, Jordan. I mean, with just like your intersection of speaking and disability rights and your future as in sleep and neurology is just so, so cool. So, and I guess we'll say goodnight.
All right. Thank you so much. Goodbye.
All right. Bye, guys.
The Project Sleep Podcast is produced by Carver Sound Productions. For more information on podcast production services, visit carversoundproductions.com.